You are listening to How Do We Make It Better, the podcast where we explore how people in nonprofits, corporations, social enterprises, politics, and other walks of life try to make it better. Get this where all quality podcasts are found. Links to all those places are at bit.ly/How Do We Make It Better Podcast, or if that's too long, bit.ly/HDWMIB. You can also check us out at dougabdiel.com. That's dougabdiel.com. Today I interviewed Scott Riddle. He's a fellow Googler. We worked together for a couple of years and were even scheming. Well, first I was scheming to try and get him as my boss because I have a real strict policy of making sure that I only work for really great people if I can help it. And then at 36 years old, and just a month later, he got a stage 4 cancer diagnosis, and all of our schemes about social enterprises and what we were going to do at Google, they got a big pause button pushed on them. And I personally have been really encouraged by the way Scott has dealt with this. He's chosen not to externalize frustration and anger, but to take the rest of us through a reevaluation of what's important in his life and encourage all of us to hug our kids more, to do the practical things like sort out our finances. And you'll hear a bit of that today. I hope that during this time that you appreciate the direction that I'm trying to go with this. It isn't my ordinary, oh, what are you trying to do to make the world a little bit better? This is an image of somebody whose life was very much heading in that direction, had gone to talk to venture capitalists about getting his own social enterprise started and was really working through how to make the world a better place, and then got hit with this. And the way that he dealt with it, I think, really shines through the type of person that he is. And I hope that this is a bit of encouragement to you, a bit of time for you to sit back and reflect, even if we're a little bit after the beginning of the new year, and think about what's important, what the life is that you're living, and how, if you knew that you only had a couple months to go, you might pivot. Scott, thanks for taking the time to join me on January 2nd. This is a interesting time, I think, for everybody to stop and sit and reflect. And we always have interesting conversations and have had plenty of them in the past. But I think, especially you and I now, given some of your changed circumstances, I think your voice would be very interesting for people to listen to and pause and reflect in this new year about some of the different directions that you're taking, the kinds of things that you think are valuable. Before we dive into that, maybe we could just do a bit of an intro about you and where you've come from and why your accent sounds like kind of an evil Australian version of English, but not quite Australian. I don't know. Maybe a brief intro about yourself.
Cool. Well, I guess if you want the accent explanation, I have to go quite far back. I was born in South Africa, which explains the semi kind of weird accent. I lived there until I was about, I think, 13, 14, and then moved to New Zealand, spent 10 years there, finished high school, university in New Zealand, and then moved to Australia in around about 2004, 2005. And I've kind of been in Australia ever since, but I spent a year in the UK and then 4 years in the US, and Australia has been a base, but I've kind of been jumping around a little bit from Sydney and coming to and fro. So that explains the accent.
Fair enough. And we met, well, I think, I don't know that you even recall, I believe that I met you at my first day in Google. We shook hands and then you headed off. We kind of nearly crossed one another in the air. You were heading to Mountain View and I was starting a few desks away from you at Google. And we just happened to be working basically on the same teams for a couple of years in strategy and ops. And one of the things that always struck me about you was that you think a little bit differently than the average individual. And aside from your genuine, and I'm not just, you know, patting you on the back here, your genuine intellectual capacity, which I think anybody would be a little bit stunned by the different areas in which you've succeeded. But the last conversation that we had, we were sitting in our offices in Sydney, and we were talking about our respective schemes to start social enterprise empires. And I think you were talking about buying up vacant land and trying to make ecotourism areas and trying to make the world a better place in that way. And we're all fired up about it. Yeah. And you just needed this one little bridge for a couple more years before you're able to move over there. And then, you know, a couple months back, life, I think, changed a bit for you. Maybe talk us through what happened, where you're at now, and what life looks like now.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's very different from those conversations, that's for sure. Yeah. So we would have been having that conversation in probably like June, July. So I was actually living in the States. So I was working for Google there for 4 years. I started with Google in Australia and then I transferred over to the US and spent just under 4 years there. And I moved back in, when was it? June, July, end of June, early July. So I started my new contract with Google Australia on 10th of July. I remember that. Basically, I kind of went to the GP and it kind of spiraled from there. And after a couple of days, I was diagnosed with cancer, colon cancer. That was at the very end of July. And then it just kind of got worse and worse from there. They did more and more scans and kind of investigations. And it, cut a long story short, it turned out that I actually had stage 4 cancer, which is the shittiest kind of cancer you can have. If you don't know much about cancer, and I did not know, I've realized now how little I really knew about cancer before. There's 4 stages. So, you know, stage 1, you have a small localized tumor. Stage 2, a little bit worse. Stage 3, you've got some lymph spread. Stage 4 basically means that you have a primary tumor in one organ or one part of your body, and it's spread from there to nearby tissue and lymph nodes. And it's kind of gone wild and it's traveled somewhere else in your body and created a secondary tumor, or what they call a metastasis. And that's the definition of stage 4. And in the old days, and when I say the old days, I mean like, I don't know, 5-10 years ago, it was basically a terminal diagnosis. If you had stage 4, you were considered like terminal, because they kind of felt then that once the cancer had metastasized, there was kind of no going back. It was just a matter of keeping you alive for as long as possible. Now things are a little bit better, not much better, but again, to cut a long story short, my doctors, if I looked at the statistics when I was diagnosed in August, you know, as you do, you kind of jump on Google and do some of your own research. And my own research suggested that I had a 20% chance of being alive in 5 years based on what they call the survival curves, which are, you know, the medical stats from people who have this diagnosis. You know, my doctors pointed out that those stats are, they're always by nature kind of 5 years out of date because it takes a while to collect the stats. I'm younger than the average patient with my diagnosis by a considerable margin. Yada, yada, yada. There's lots of other factors. And they think I have a 50-50 chance of survival. So that was all of that diagnosis kind of happened in August. And if you want the latest state of play, I did then in quick succession radiation and chemo. I did 5 weeks of radiation, 4 cycles of chemotherapy. And then in November, I had a massive operation. It was actually 2 operations in one. They were going to decide on the day whether they did one operation or both operations, and it would be dependent on how well my body was coping with the operation, but they ended up doing both. So they did the primary tumor removal, which basically entailed cutting out a massive chunk of my colon and basically scraping out my pelvis. So they took out 37 lymph nodes and a whole bunch of tissue around the colon. That was operation number one. And then they, apparently I was doing okay after that. So they then went and did the liver, which is where my cancer had spread to. So I had 2 small tumors in the liver as well. So they chopped a chunk of my liver out as well. Yeah, so that surgery was on the 23rd of November. And then we got the pathology results back just very recently, actually, like in the last week or so, well, the last 2 weeks, which wasn't very good. Of the 37 lymph nodes that they took out, 17 of them had cancer. 9 of them, I forget the exact, it's I think 8 or 9 still had some cancer, but some of the others had been, like the radiation had kind of got to it. But I guess the scariest, well, there's a couple of things from that pathology. One was they could see that the cancer was very aggressive and fast growing. Secondly, it was just the extent of the spread. So when they do the technical staging and diagnosis of cancer, they look at, well, there's several things they look at, but one of the things that they look at is the extent to which the cancer has spread into your lymph nodes. And they have a scale that kind of goes, you know, 1 lymph node, 2 lymph nodes, 3 lymph nodes. And that scale ends at 7, like the official scale. So anything above 7 is like the worst level. So if you can imagine, the scale stops at 7 and I had 17. So I basically have quite bad spread. And then the third piece of bad news from that pathology was that when they did the chemo and radiation before surgery, you can't, well, you can do radiation on your liver, but it's pretty hardcore. So I didn't get radiation on my liver. I only got it on my colon. And what they could tell was that the radiation was very effective. Like when they looked at the tumor tissue after the surgery, they said, you know, the radiation was very, very effective at killing the cancer in the colon. They almost found no residual cancer left because the radiation had been so good at zapping it. But in the liver, where the cancer had spread to, they saw very little effect from the chemotherapy. Because there was no radiation done there, they were relying on chemotherapy. And what they saw there was kind of like just a 20%, what do they call it, regression of the tumor. So, you know, and they were expecting much more like 50, 60, 70%. So what that told them is that the chemotherapy wasn't very effective. And that's concerning because...
You can't irradiate your entire body.
Yeah, I mean, you can't really do radiation on... Well, you can. There is another thing you can do where you do that, but it's not on the cards anytime soon. So really what the plan was originally was, you know, you do the surgery and then you have what they call like a cleanup round of chemotherapy afterwards. But the worrying thing is they were a bit surprised by how much spread there was in the lymph nodes when they did the pathology work, which means that there's obviously the odds are that there's a ton of cancer still floating around in my body. I technically don't have any tumors now, but there probably are lots of cancer cells floating around in my bloodstream, which really means it's kind of a matter of time before it anchors somewhere else and grows another tumor. But because the chemo wasn't very effective on the liver metastases, it's, well, you know, all combined, it's not a very good sign. So they're busy scheming ways of bumping up the chemo regime and adding some new drugs and everything. So yeah, anyway, that was a not so short version of where I am today. I have to get what they call a port inserted on Thursday, a couple of days from now, which is like an implant in your chest with direct access to your arteries to make chemotherapy easier, because all of my veins in my arms have collapsed from the chemo already. And then the next day, Friday, I start my next rounds of chemo. So that's where I am.
So I guess that's where you are physically today. One of the things that I really wanted to talk to you about, and what I was honestly really encouraged about, was some of the posts that you've been doing on your website, elsewhere, just talking to everybody. I think this is something that we deal with extraordinarily badly in Western society right now, is when people struggle, how do we help them? We're very good at glad-handing people and saying, you know, that you've done a great job, everybody gets a prize. But when people are genuinely struggling in life, just kind of sucks. We struggle with how to support them. And most people I find kind of go internal in these times. And you've had some really encouraging things to say about the values that you thought you had and how your mind and your brain space has evolved, quite aside from, well, I guess they're not disjoint, you're not a disembodied mind or anything like that, but about how your thinking about what was important has changed and how you're thinking about the present, how you're thinking about the future, how you're thinking about even this Christmas and this holiday period. So I guess I would like it if you would have time to just share with everybody, perhaps in verbal form, some of the things that you feel are important to you now, quite aside from the physical things that are happening to you, and kind of what you're taking out of this experience and what life looks like for you now.
Yeah, I'll try and answer that as best as I can. It's kind of an interesting time to be asking this question because, you know, it is the 2nd of January and it's the new year. And it's, you know, as you said at the beginning, it's traditionally a time of year where you reflect on a lot of things. And I found this new year intellectually challenging because of the current state of affairs. So, I mean, to cut a long story short, like when you say what's important to me now, the short answer is really just family. That's it, really. Because everything else is so uncertain, it's kind of hard to think about career. It's hard to think about starting a business. It's hard to think about anything else. So it's very difficult for anything else to be important because I just don't know how to even think about some of those things at the moment. But one thing that is just very, very obviously important and stands out above everything else is my family, and like in particular my kids. I've got three young kids, a 6-year-old, a 4-year-old, and the little guy just turned 1 in December. I think, yeah, I mean, there's been lots of scary things about this whole journey and diagnosis and everything, but the one thing that's become immediately clear is that a lot of the other things that I used to think were important really are not that important. And the one thing that is very important to me anyway is those kids and my wife and family. So that kind of stands out. And I, you know, you talked about some of the posts that I've done. Probably the one that's had the biggest effect was one, I forget when I wrote it, must have been in August sometime when I found out that it was stage 4 cancer, and I kind of had a bit of a freak out. And I actually think I wrote it the night that I had done my own research and figured out that I had a 20% chance of being alive in 5 years, and I hadn't yet spoken to my doctors and heard that the odds were maybe a little bit better. So I was having this freak out, and I kind of just sat down, and I don't know why, but I've never even posted on Medium before. In fact, I've never posted anything before aside from, you know, the occasional Facebook post. But I, for whatever reason, sat down, and I only just kind of took like 15 minutes, and I just threw down what I was thinking. And the key thing was just this, I guess, like in that moment of kind of panic, you kind of think, wow, like, you know, what have I done? Like, I guess it's a bit cheesy, but I guess it's kind of one version of, you know, the so-called life rushing before your eyes when you're about to die. You know, when you have like a fear of dying, suddenly you think about all this stuff. And it did make me think that, you know, as I said before, so many of the things that I used to worry about and used to, you know, spend a lot of time and energy thinking about or investing in really are not that important. I've always been a person that kind of stresses a little bit too much about getting things just right or getting the timing right or, you know, executing on something really well. And suddenly all of that just seemed like total crap. And it was more just about, for me again, like, oh my God, I might not be alive to see my 6-year-old turn 10 or my 1-year-old turn 3. So it was just kind of a complete mind shift in terms of what's important and priorities. And I guess for other people, outside of myself, I just suddenly had this kind of desire to, you know, run around to my friends and family and shake them and say, you know, you have no idea how lucky you are not to, you know, to be healthy. And to, given that health, you should be kind of just, you know, making the most of things and, you know, live each day as if it's your last, because you're healthy and, you know, you've just got so much to be thankful for. And yeah, I think people just forget how lucky they are and don't take advantage of the big opportunity that life is.
And has your opinion since August, has your thought kind of stayed the same? Or how, I guess it's so quintessentially you, Scott, that you would take this opportunity to remind others and reach out to others and shake them by the shoulders and say, hey, look, there's still chance for you. You can fix this. You can make things better. And that's what's so amazing. If there is anything that is good that can be taken out of this right now, I think it's that. But I think you probably have already changed and shaken a lot of people's lives up just by who you are, by the force of the words that you put out. Since you wrote that in August to now, do you have any amendments to that? Do you have anything that's changed since then? Or is the message still the same? Just look at your family, spend time with them, live every day like it's your last, if that's a nice synopsis of it. Or is there anything that upon longer reflection for more than 15 minutes, you feel like, oh, if I could change it, this is what the message I would put out today?
No, I don't think so. I mean, that Medium post, which, I mean, it kind of blew me away. The response to that post has been read by, I think, like 500,000 people now, and it's been reposted all over the place. That particular post that I did, I don't think I would change the message. You know, that is still how I feel. And I haven't read it for quite a while, but I, you know, remembering the sentiment and kind of the basic message of it. No, I wouldn't change that. I think, you know, if the question was, has my thinking evolved beyond that? The answer would be yes. So definitely, I wouldn't change that post because that message is the same and, you know, it holds true today. But I've had to change my thinking quite a bit as time's gone on just to figure out a way of, you know, that was in August, like days after I got this diagnosis. I've had to, over the ensuing months, come up with a way of living, like continuing to exist with this kind of weird uncertainty, dark cloud thing hanging over you. And you don't really know what's going to happen month to month, or, you know, certainly year to year, but even month to month. And I've had to figure out a way, like I've called it like a duality, or sometimes I call it the two-track system, because you have this very weird situation where you have to be very optimistic about everything, because, you know, everyone tells you that, you know, mindset's very important and you don't want to give up and yada, yada, yada. But on the other hand, you have to be pragmatic. And like, as I said, I have a wife and 3 kids, and, you know, what are they going to do if I die? And there's a whole practical side to this thing. So you have to do this weird, as I said, I've called it my two-track system, where track one is, hey, I'm going to be fine. I'm going to be that statistical anomaly, and I'm going to survive this thing, and I'll be alive in 15 years. And you have to kind of continue to plan for what your life might look like and not just stand still. You have to kind of keep doing things. That's track one. And then track two is, okay, at some point soon, I'm going to get some bad news, and, you know, I'm not going to be around in 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 years. And I have to plan for that. So it's things like, you know, I didn't have a will, and I have to figure out financial issues for my family and, you know, all that kind of thing. So, but it's very hard to mix both of those tracks of thought, because it's, you know, normally, you know, the average, as I say, healthy person could be like, okay, I'm going to set myself a goal that in 2 years I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. I'm going to run this race or start this business or whatever. But for me, it's like, I can't really do that. I can't kind of go, okay, in 2 years I'm going to do X, Y, Z, because I have no idea. If I'm lucky to be alive, I might not be that, you know, I don't know what my condition is going to be like. So it's very hard to plan. But then at the same time, you have to be making some progress on the track two stuff. So it's like, oh, I'm going to think about this business thing or this social enterprise thing for this hour. And then next hour, I have to do some funeral planning. It's kind of, they're very hard things to mesh together. Again, sorry, that was like a long-winded answer to, you know, when you said, has my mind shifted from when I wrote that post? Yes, it has, because of all that other stuff. But would the essential message of that post still be the same? Yes, it would, because I still think that's a really important message.
I've seen some of these kinds of juxtapositions before, and not nearly as proximately as you, kind of been in similar situations deploying with the Marine Corps. Simultaneously, it's, yes, babe, of course I'm coming home. Everything's going to be fine. And let's actually fill out our will and make sure everything is sorted out. And you optimistically move towards the hope that you have, but you don't have any real certainty that it's there. I guess if you could, in truth, most of us are living in that in ignorance. The strange thing about Marines is especially males of a certain age, they think they're invincible. They'll do really erratic and irrational things with their lives, which I'm sure has some kind of mimetic benefits for society, where they're willing to sacrifice themselves for the greater good of society for a few years before they settle down and have families. And there's probably a very good genetic reason that they hold on loosely to life, but they will be overly brave and overly thoughtless. They're the Billy don't be a hero kinds of guys, and take that old song if you know it. But in truth, we're all kind of living in that world, whether or not we admit it. The guys who got killed in the tsunami a couple of years ago around this time of year in a resort, who are tourists enjoying their lives, had it taken away from them, but we're living completely in this optimistic land without living this pragmatic existence about risk planning. On that side, I guess, is there something in that vein outside of the Medium post that you would admonish those of us who don't think that we're in that spot today, but whose lives are kind of random? And women still die in childbirth, people get hit by cars, all kinds of things happen, that you think in retrospect you would tell Scott Riddle in July to do differently?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's funny that you bring up the, you know, the guy that died in a tsunami, because I've said that to my wife and a lot of friends and family recently, you know, when people are very down on my situation, and I'll say, hey, like the upside of this, like if you try and find the positive, it's that I actually have advanced warning. So, you know, what I mean by that is I've suddenly become super sensitive to people who die spontaneously, like Arctic stories about that. So I'll open the newspaper and I'm sure they were always there, and I'm sure I read the articles before, but now suddenly I'm like, my attention and consciousness goes to these articles, and I really think about the situation in much more detail. And almost every day you can open the newspaper and there's a story about someone who got out of bed that day and thought that it was just going to be a normal day, but they died that day. And it could be, you know, a car accident or, you know, whatever, terrorist attack, tsunami, earthquake, medical misadventure, you know, all sorts of things. People die a lot. And I guess the way I kind of think about the upside for me is, what would you, if you were given a choice, if someone came to you and said, I can give you some advanced notice, I can give you somewhere between 1 and 5 years to get your shit together, because you're going to die. Or like sometime in the next 50 years, you're just going to die like instantly, and you know, you've got no kind of prep time. And I actually think there's some advantage to the former, like where you're actually given this advance warning, which is effectively my current situation, because you have, for whatever period of time you have, you're hyper conscious of it being a limited amount of time, and you start to, you know, do things differently. And I guess this comes back to your question about like, what would I say to people? There's a bit of a spectrum. Like, so from the very philosophical and kind of life stuff to very pragmatic. And I mean, if I get the pragmatic stuff out of the way first, I'm very lucky. I work at Google and they have great insurance and stuff. And I never really read the insurance small print. Every year you get asked to elect your benefits at work, and I just like tick the basic boxes. I didn't even think I ticked any boxes. I just like checked to make sure that some default was going to be ticked for me, and kind of away I went. Now, in hindsight, I realize I'm very lucky. that Google did that stuff for employees by default. But for a lot of people, it sounds funny because suddenly start talking about like practical stuff like insurance and financials. But when something does go wrong, I've just realized how important stuff like life insurance is, you know, or income protection insurance. You know, I was talking to a neighbor the other day and she said, oh my God, if this happened to my husband or I, we would be screwed. Like, we don't have any income protection insurance or health insurance or life insurance or anything. And for me now, it's a huge comfort because I'm like, okay, well, if I die, there's going to be some life insurance. Right now, I haven't been at work for 4 or 5 months and I've got some income protection insurance. So yeah, that's probably not the answer you're expecting. But seriously, like this whole like financial planning thing is actually really important. And when you're late 20s, 30s, even like, you know, late 30s, 40s, you're kind of like, well, that doesn't really apply to me. Like, you know, I'm not going to die anytime soon, so I don't really need to worry about that. Trust me, you should think about it because you could be in my situation or you could be in the guy that died in a tsunami situation. You really just don't know. Like, you can't be blissfully ignorant to the fact that you may die sooner than you expect. So that's kind of the pragmatic. And then I guess on the life thing, it's really what I said in that Medium post. It's just really appreciate to appreciate life and to appreciate health. You know, I've spent a lot of time in hospitals myself lately and talked to a lot of other patients and oh my God, like there's people who can't pee or who struggle to breathe or who like every day is a challenge because they just don't have their health. And having been a perfectly healthy person right up until my diagnosis, I was never sick with anything of any, you know, beyond the occasional cold or flu. I realize now I just completely took that for granted. And if you take your health, if you appreciate your health and you appreciate, you know, being alive, I think you just live a very different life because you suddenly become hypersensitive to sitting in traffic for an hour a day because you're like, my God, I'm healthy and life is great. And, you know, I shouldn't be wasting 2 hours each way commuting, or this meeting is just a complete waste of all of our collective life. Yeah, it just changes the way you think if you really appreciate life and your health.
Look, I appreciate both the practical sides of that. And just for everybody's benefit, I think you're 36?
I just turned 36 in October.
Just turned 36. So we probably should have put that in the intro, but in the realm of no kidding, this could happen to you. It's not something that any of us are thinking when I'm 33, you're 3 years older. This is not something that's in my wheelhouse, especially after removing myself, at least on active duty from the military. But one of the things that still strikes me, even the way that you frame these things, looking for silver linings in conversations with your wife, looking for silver linings with the people you talk to, finding lessons even now in this. Is this that method of thinking, this perpetually trying to find the good, even in the negative things that are happening to you, is that way of thinking something that is just endogenous to you? Like, is it just your natural mindset? Or has there been something that you've read or something that's encouraged you to kind of think this way? I mean, it sounds like your Medium post, at least, that was all endogenous. That was just Scott Riddle and who you are. What's really amazing to me, having been somebody who I don't know that I've said this very much, but my second job was in a nursing home. I moved from McDonald's to Wanakee Manor. I got paid $12 an hour. I thought I was really making big bucks and life was great. But bar none, that was the hardest job that I have ever had, to include being a Marine. I'll put that in there. My job was to feed, change, bathe the elderly people who were just waiting for the end to come. And some of the people who are in that stage of their lives were reflections of themselves earlier. If they were embittered people prior to that, then they were embittered in the nursing home. Some people who were happy and loved life found joy while they were there as well. And you're clearly in this second category here. And I guess what I would love to know from you is how you continue to try and aim for that silver lining. Like, how is that your mindset and how do you continue to try and find these ways of thinking for yourself? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I think people have given me way too much credit. Because, you know, I get a lot of people saying to me, oh my God, like, it's amazing that you've taken all this time to, you know, I do this blog posts. Okay, I'm not a frequent poster, but I set up a blog.
Yeah, you put out more blog posts than I do. I don't have to go through surgery, and I don't have three kids. I've got one, and I'm struggling to keep up with it.
But yeah, a lot of people say, "Oh, it's so great that you're taking the time to write this thing." And that's a classic example where people give me way too much credit, because frankly, the only reason I started that blog and continue to write it is I was finding it extremely difficult. You know, I have a lot of friends because I've lived in three different countries and, you know, spent time in different places. My kind of friendship circle is very dispersed. I actually have like very few friends in Sydney, but a lot of them are living in London or the States or, you know, South Africa or whatever. And it was very, very hard to keep people informed. So I was getting all these emails and texts and Facebook messages and whatever from people asking, you know, what's going on? What, you know, after they found out that I had cancer, it was getting really annoying. And likewise, locally, I would go somewhere and I'd see someone that I hadn't seen for a while and they'd hit me with all these questions and they'd want to know, like, you know, what was happening there? What's the surgery? So I was like, I just need to write something that I can just refer people to. And I just write it once. And then, you know, in the situation where I rock up somewhere and someone says, well, you know, what's been happening? I can just say, hey, like, I just read the latest post or something. It really is just a great mechanism for me to get people off my back sometimes. Cause yeah, it just saves me answering a lot of questions. And then the second benefit is another selfish benefit in that I actually find it really helpful to process. It's funny, like you go to one of these doctor's meetings and they hit you with all this bad news, whether it be like the diagnosis itself or the pathology. And you kind of don't really, it just kind of sits, I find anyway, in my like surface mind. But then if I write about it, I don't know, I just process it in a different way. Because you have to kind of order your thoughts to write it down. And I find it very helpful. I always feel better having, no matter how bad the news is, I find it better having just written a little post about it because it's somehow just cleaner in my own mind. So I know those are all very kind of selfish reasons. And I'd say as well, you know, when you say, is there something else that's made me think this way? In one word, I would say it's necessity. It's not that I've read some great Buddhist book or thing about life. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I have been reading a lot of Buddhist books and books about life and things lately, but none of them are driving me to think the way I'm thinking or do what I'm doing. It's really just necessity, because personally, if I didn't think about the silver lining stuff or the good stuff or the possibilities or try and find some benefit in this whole thing, I think I'd probably, you know, just be like a heap on the ground. It's kind of relentless bad news, relentless treatment, chemotherapy, like nausea. Like it's just kind of, it's pretty shit. But if you can kind of be like, oh, I'm going to like try and write a post to find the good in this, or I'm going to like, I don't know, like I'm doing it out of necessity, not because I'm some really great person or, you know, I have a soul naturally endowed with joy or anything like that. It's really necessity.
I'll take you back to that nursing home again, and I'll see if I can come at this question from a different direction, because part of what made that time working in the nursing home the most difficult job that I have ever had was I remember one woman, it was a Sunday. I often work Sundays and weekends because I had school, and I took these threadbare clothes, which she was so proud of. They were the best ones still in her wardrobe. She had clearly not bought anything for herself in years, because she was planning for the end. And this was a spring morning on a Sunday in Wisconsin after a bunch of dark winter time. And all this woman wanted was for her family to come pick her up in the car and just drive her around for an hour and a half. That would have made her entire Sunday. And I don't know what happened with her family. I didn't talk to them. I just watched as the day got longer, and she went from being elated in the morning at the prospect of her family coming to pick her up and take her on a drive to having to quietly embrace the reality that the family that she had invested so much in, that she continued to invest in by only wearing threadbare clothes so she could give them some type of an inheritance, had probably decided that watching some sporting event on TV was more important than picking her up or even giving her a call to let her know that she wasn't going to go on that drive in the country. And the thing that stuck out in my mind about that, aside from the horribleness of the situation, was her mindset in it. She took that kind of great weight, that big hit on her shoulders at that day, and moved on and moved through and said, you know, they must have just gotten busy. They're very busy people. They work very hard. You know, let's just go off to dinner and you can eat the stuff that the cafeterias making and this kind of stuff, and let's get ready for bed. And that was just the opposite reaction of some other people who were in that facility who felt like, look, I am entitled to this time with my family. I'm entitled to this. I have a very defined set of expectations about the way the world is going to work and the way other people are going to treat me. And if it didn't work out, they vociferously reacted against that. And those were the people who I almost never felt bad for. I don't know, it's a, you know, talk a bit Buddhist, is a bit like, you've probably spent your entire life elbowing other people out, and there's a bit of karma coming back because you're just an unpleasant person to spend time with. But those who were positive and cared for the people who through their entire adult lives they had been through, those were the folks who I really, my heart just bled for, and why I found that I had to quit. Ultimately, I had to go work at a gas station was my next job. I took the pay cut because like, this is too hard. I can't do this anymore. But I never had the chance to ask them what I get a chance to ask you now, again, in a different direction, because most of them were not incredibly lucid at that time. And because I was 15 years old or 14, why is it that you, Scott Riddle, are able to take these things on the chin? What is it about your history? I mean, you say you need to do it. Well, the truth is you don't need to do it. I've seen other people not do it. Why is it? What is it about your history? What is it about your makeup? What is it that you continue to say, oh, well, look, I'm going to find a silver lining because I need to. I need that for me. I need to find some positive. And I still care about what my friends in London are asking me. And I'm not just going to ignore their text messages. And I'm not going to, you know, react negatively to them. That is odd, Scott. You're like, at least in my limited experience with this, there's almost a bimodal distribution of people here. And you're on the one side of this bimodal distribution. Even in a really difficult time, you are finding ways, and you say it's just for you. That's fine. But where does that come from? Like, is it something you grew up with? Is it something that got embedded? Is it some religious practice that you had earlier? Like, tell me, where does that come from?
I don't know. I'm probably going to give you a really bad answer here because I haven't really thought about it much, and I've never really thought about myself being different to what anyone else would do or in this circumstance. But I guess, you know, I was listening to you relaying the story about the lady at the nursing home, and I think really, if you think about it, it's about pragmatism. Like, you know, you can get, and I think maybe that's really what it. It's not so much a religious lesson or anything. It's more, you know, my life is such that I have learned to be pragmatic. And, you know, if you have a few setbacks in your life, or you have an experience like working in a nursing home, or like you did, or you're whatever, you kind of end up being endowed with a bit more of a sense of just pragmatism. So, and what I mean by that is, like, you know, sure, you could get a piece of bad news and kind of wallow in it. And allow yourself to kind of, again, fall in a heap. Or you could be kind of pragmatic and say, like, okay, what can I do here? I can either fall in a heap, but then for whatever time I have left, you know, the quality of that time is going to be really limited by that kind of attitude. So I just have to be pragmatic and take it on the chin and try and find some good. Yeah, I think, as I said, when I was listening to you speak, I just thought, well, that's really about just being pragmatic. You know, your family doesn't rock up at the nursing home. You have to be pragmatic and say, okay, well, maybe there was a reason they didn't. Or even if there wasn't a reason, you know, who cares? Like, I just have to kind of move on. So yeah, for me, I'm an atheist. I've gone through Buddhist phases a couple of times where I'd call myself a Buddhist. At least Buddhism is the closest religion that I can kind of, well, I don't think Buddhism is a religion, but that's a different conversation. But yeah, I'm an atheist, Buddhist tendencies. I definitely don't think it's like, you know, my religious upbringing or anything, because I didn't have one. Yeah, I think it's just for whatever reason, I've had a life where you end up being pragmatic.
It's an interesting kind of pragmatism. You know, the old trope about pragmatism, the thing about it is that it doesn't work. There are many types of pragmatism. And some people have somehow learned, as you know, our brain works via a series of inputs and outputs and a bunch of neurons connecting to hundreds of other neurons and doing several feedback loops, and have somehow learned that it is pragmatically best for them to optimize for the results they want in their life by externalizing their pain. And you haven't done that. And it's just I'm trying to draw out what makes that different and why that neural network has been formed in your brain, quite apart from any mind spirit duality in any religion, like what, why that was the case for you. But I'll leave that to one side because it seems like it's something that you haven't fully grappled with, and I'm probably not phrasing it very well.
No, I know what you mean. I've never thought about it. I've never thought that I was sufficiently different to, in that respect, to invest time in figuring out why I'm different. So I just, I'm not good at answering the question.
Well, and like all Australians, I think find yourself being quite self-deprecating, which is one of the other things we love about you, Scott. On your dipping into and out of Buddhism and on things that you've been reading and things that you've personally been finding encouraging, is there anything that you have read or that you would commend to others that you've taken the time to look at in the last 6 months? I'm sure a whole bunch of it's been medical stuff, but perhaps aside from the medical components that you're like, well, look, there's a bit of wisdom in there that either I wish I'd had earlier or that I find myself in right now. If people can identify the kind of preciousness of life now, somebody else that encapsulates some of the thinking that you have now.
Well, I mean, you're right. A lot of the stuff I've been reading about is kind of medical and health related. But some of those I think are kind of more universal. Like, so, you know, you read them when you find out you've got bad cancer, but you actually should have read this thing like 20 years ago. Like one of those books is, there's a book called Anti-Cancer. I forget now, David someone, I forget his surname, the guy that wrote it, Dr. David something. But anyway, it's written for people who have cancer, obviously. Well, actually, no, it's written for people who have cancer, but it's also written for people who don't have cancer but want to not get cancer. But I think the only people that would buy and read that book are people that have cancer. And I guess what I'm saying is it's a book that kind of talks about ways that you can live your life to not have cancer and, you know, swap out cancer with heart disease and yada, 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 many, many other bad health things. And it's just things like, he's got four basic principles and I'm going to forget them, but it's basically, you know, your diet, eliminating exposure to chemicals. You know, we live in a world that the more I've read about this, the more kind of horrifying it is, just how much, you know, post-World War II with the kind of industrial society that we live in and the advent of plastics and chemicals and everything, just in the last like 50 years, we've gone from a society where there's not that much chemicals around us to like basically we're swimming in chemicals from the moment we wake up. So he talks about ways of kind of removing yourself from that and taking it out of your life. He talks about stress, and I said I was going to forget the fourth one I had, but that, I think that book was great. But I've read a lot of stuff about that, which is, you know, do something with your diet, remove stress in your life, get rid of, I guess, contamination in your life. And I think that's something that anyone would benefit from. Again, like you don't have to have cancer to benefit from that. The funny thing is most people only think about that stuff when the shit hits the fan and you do get a really bad diagnosis. Whereas the benefit would really accrue if people, you know, were taught that kind of stuff in school or something. And then I've also read a lot of stuff about, you know, this kind of life messaging stuff. So there's a great book, I'm not really good on surnames, written by Randy Bush or something, called The Last Lecture, which was kind of good. It was, you know, basically a guy that had pancreatic cancer and he was going to die. He was a professor at, I think it was Berkeley. And he decided he was going to do this last lecture where he basically talks about lessons in his life and thing, you know, key takeaways that he'd like people to have. And I think that was really good. And it was a book that I would love my kids to read, for example, early on in their lives, because I think it had a lot of good takeaways. Again, you would tend to only read that book when your life is coming to an end, but the people who would really benefit from reading that kind of stuff are, you know, people who are perfectly healthy at the beginning of their lives to make sure that they can fully benefit from it. So yeah, yes, I've read a lot. I've read a lot of again, Buddhist stuff and meaning of life type of stuff. But if I was going to kind of give a few key takeaways, it would be, you know, this whole health thing. It's not really just for people who are sick. It really is for other people as well. Yeah. And secondly, just this, you know, how to make the most of life kind of thing.
That's fair. Look, I'll put links to your article in Medium as well as your blog, as well as Anti-Cancer and The Last Lecture of these books in the show notes. So if anybody's listening and wants to quickly jump to those, they're in the show notes of whatever you're listening to this podcast on.
Yeah, I'll send you most afterwards, because I have read some really good stuff. I just, I've got a bad memory at the moment. I've got chemo brain. So I'll send you a list.
That would be really great. And I think everybody would appreciate that. I do want to touch back on this religion component for you. One of the previous podcasts that I had was with a couple of Anglican ministers who've dedicated their entire lives to trying to reach out and create community and develop people of faith. And that's their entire life's work. And I don't think this is probably the right forum to get into a debate about, you know, whether or not how the world was created and whether or not there are just pro-social memes to around religion or what have you. But I think it's worth reflecting on why certain memes, at least from even from an atheist standpoint, why certain ideas stick around for so long. If there was no benefit to society of some things like the norm against in-group violence, the thou shalt not kill in the biblical sense, then they probably wouldn't stick around very long. Like, we don't have very many cannibal religions around anymore because that meme has worked its way out of society. And there has at least been some wisdom in some of those things that gets passed down through text and print and chant and these things. I'm curious, a lot of people, there's the old phrase, there's no atheists in foxholes. Right? A lot of people do turn in that direction, their dark times and in their last hours. And that hasn't been, it seems, something that has been a balm for you. And I guess, is that not something you have explored, or have you explored it? You're like, I didn't find a lot of truth there. It's not that useful for me, I guess. Can you talk me through where your religious journey post this has come? It's okay to say, look, I didn't even start there. I didn't travel down that path. So I'm not going to.
No, my wife and I kind of argue a little bit about religion because I'm what you would call an activist atheist. So I have quite strong views about I've thought a lot about religion over the years, because
you fall into the Richard Dawkins school, like that this there's a lot of really negative things that come out of religion, and if we could get rid of it, then we'd have people who wouldn't kill each other nearly as much. And yeah,
that's me. I'm a selfish gene kind of guy. Selfish gene, for those that don't know, that's one of Richard Dawkins' books. You know, it's funny because I come from one side of my family is very religious, and I can totally understand it and I can relate to it and I can get it because I spent some of my childhood going into church and Sunday schools and everything. So I get it, but it's not for me. And I figured that out a long time ago. So there was no way that, you know, I get a terminal cancer diagnosis and I suddenly convert. That was never going to happen. And if anything, I take great comfort from my atheism because, you know, if I was Catholic or something, I'd be worried about something I did when I was younger. And, you know, maybe I was going to go to purgatory or something, or whatever. So I actually find my kind of atheist outlook on things quite comforting at this time. So no, religion is just, I'm trying to hold myself back here because I don't think we want to kind of turn this into a like religious thing. But no, short answer is no, I did not go down a religious path to seek comfort. And again, I know what you mean. I've got lots of friends who have had bad stuff happen in their lives and they did find religion and fall on it quite heavily as a coping mechanism. But for me, that's not really an option.
Look, that's totally fair. This is your story, not mine or anybody else's. And the way that you move through life is your own. I do think even from a religious kind of, I remember reading a book, what was it called? I went to a Christian high school, and one of the books we were asked to read was something by C.S. Lewis, where he talked about the atheist who lives their entire life and then says, oh, look, on my deathbed, I'm going to repent. And then I'll at least win Pascal's wager, right? I'll live the life that I wanted to lead, and then I'll still repent and everything will be good and I'll go to heaven at the end. And I think much like you continually finding the silver lining in things, some of who Scott Riddle is has only been amplified through this experience a bit. And you're like, well, look, no, I didn't find that to be useful before. I'm not going to find that to be useful now. But there are certainly other things where, for instance, your time with your family, where you're like, well, look, I had that balance wrong before, and you've moved through and found those things to be much more useful. So I was just trying to tease out the differences, because I know that is a major thing for a lot of people, about why certain patterns are patterns that you hold on to and certain patterns are ones that you let go of. And that's your own story. Okay. Look, this is a bit of an atypical interview. And I think at this time, it would probably be interesting to just turn the floor over to you and say, you know, is there anything that I shouldn't have asked, or that I should have asked you that I didn't ask you? And then if you can just move into answering that question for yourself, I guess if this is a message that does go all over the world, and you've got folks in the UK and Australia and the United States, and you just have a forum to say whatever you'd like to say to them now, let me just turn the floor over to you.
Yeah, look, I don't think there's anything that you should have asked that you didn't. No, I think, again, there's the very personal aspect of this and mechanisms for getting through it, which I think we've talked about. And then there's the social benefit, like public good spillover benefit aspect, which is, you know, take it from someone who may die soon, you know, make the most of life. And I think we've talked enough about that. I think one thing that we kind of touched on, but we didn't really go there. You know, you said at the beginning that in Western culture, Western society, we're not very good at helping people who are in bad situations, whether it be health.
I think if anything, I was probably too soft on that. We suck at that. We really, really do. We're terrible at it.
I've realized one of the things I've learned is that I sucked at that as well. Me being really, really sick and being in a kind of helpless situation has kind of made me think about other times when I had friends or family who were in the same situation and, you know, what would I have done differently? And I guess one thing that I would tell people is, you know, what everyone tends to do is they'll kind of say, you know, you'll get all these messages from people saying, you know, tell me if I can do anything. Or if I can help. Take it from me, and I think I speak for almost anyone who's in the situation. No one is really going to give you a list of things that they need. Like almost, I don't know anyone, aside from their closest family, like their parents and their spouse or something, no one's going to say, oh yeah, actually, you know what I need? I need blah, 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 and this is what would be really, really helpful. No one's going to say that. But, you know, people are too proud or too embarrassed or whatever. And I think if I survive this and I am in a situation where a friend is in a bad place for whatever reason, a big learning for me is that you just have to do something. Like, just if you know them well enough, you probably know what's going to be beneficial. Don't say, hey, let me know how I can help. Just go and do it. You know, send them something or just rock up at their door. You know, check before. You know, you can kind of, you know, do it well. But if I've learned one thing is you can't just don't ask. You really can be helpful, but don't ask, because no one's going to say, this is what I need. You just have to do it. And it's funny because I was talking to someone with someone who had cancer not that long ago. And she just kind of said that out of the blue. She kind of said to me, you know, we were kind of catching up. And at the end, she said, I'm not going to ask you if you need anything, because I know you'll say no, you'll say nothing. So I'm going to, you know, do blah, 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 blah for you. And I was like, oh, you know, that's awesome. That's so kind. But I was kind of stunned by the fact that, because I feel very strongly about that. And she, as another person who's been through a kind of bad health patch, she immediately said, you know, that. And I think most people, again, most healthy people don't know that. So yeah, that was a long-winded way of saying, as a key takeaway, don't ask someone who's in a bad situation what they need. Just figure something out and just do it would be one takeaway, and something that we probably didn't talk about.
I think that's a great takeaway and probably a very good note to end on. I guess the last thing I would ask you is, I think part of the awkwardness and the difficulty in a world where American culture has suffused the world and everything's happy and everybody gets to take a trophy home and nothing ever is bad except when it is, and then we just don't talk about it, is how do we end a conversation like this? What would you like people to say to you to end their conversations with you? Do you want them to say, look, I hope you're going to get better? Or do you want them to take this pragmatic side of things and send a bunch of flowers to your family? Or like, what is it? How do we do this?
I guess I would say I have no preference for a specific thing that I would like people to say. I mean, good luck is fine. But I do have one kind of peeve that I have. And again, I know that I have this in common with many other people who have cancer in particular, because I've seen many people writing about this. But one thing that really bothers me is when you see people and they say, you're finishing their conversation and they say, you know, you've got this, you're going to beat this. You know, there's this whole language around, you know, beating and winning. And it's like, you're going to kill this cancer, you know, you're going to kind of nail this cancer. That is kind of, I don't get so pent up about this. I let it wash over me when someone says that. But I do know that a lot of people with cancer are very bothered by this, because frankly, you are helpless in this situation. Like, it's not like you've got the flu and you can, you know, go really hard on your, I don't know, immune tablets or your whatever. Like, there's very little that you can do sometimes when you have a bad cancer diagnosis. So sometimes talking about going on and on about, you know, you're going to beat this, you got this, like, you're strong, you're going to handle this, can actually be a little bit upsetting, because it's kind of like, I'm kind of doing all I can already and it's not going so well. So telling me that I'm a better person because I'm going to beat this thing is kind of not a good way of finishing the conversation. So again, I wouldn't say I have a preference for how to finish. Just say good luck or all the best with it. That's fine. But don't say to someone, you're stronger than this cancer, you're going to beat it, blah, blah, blah. Because actually, that's not necessarily true. And you're kind of putting pressure on a person or making them feel inadequate because they're like, you know, suddenly they get a bad piece of news and it's like, oh, I'm obviously doing something bad, or I'm not strong enough, or I'm not trying hard enough, or I'm not winning this fight because I'm not, you know, kicking cancer's ass, or, you know, all this kind of terminology that gets used. So yeah, that would be my request.
Fair enough. Well, I personally appreciate you in this precious time, which I know is exceptionally precious for you, just a couple of days before really hitting it hard on chemo again, and the time that you've got with your family, taking the time to spend it with me, spend it with everybody else who's listening to this. And I personally also appreciate all the messages of hope and reframing that you've provided for all of us on Medium and on your blog and everything else that you've done. And I hope that I can be a small part in spreading some of that message for you. And good luck, Scott.
It's a pleasure. Thanks. Cheers, Doug.
I want to thank Vasil Skouri for doing all the digital remastery on this track. He's a self-trained audio engineer working out of Europe. He has a collection of extraordinary tracks, both music, wordless, as well as he's done a lot of great producing work for other people. I appreciate him taking his time to clean this up and make it sound like more than just a simple recording between two people. Thanks again, Vasil.